Welcome to Literary Quest, a podcast hosted by us, Vicky and Marissa, where we discuss our favorite in fantasy fiction and hopefully can direct you in your quest to find your next great read.
Welcome to Literary Quest. Today we are discussing Under the Whispering Door by T.J. Klune. We covered one of his other books, this House on the Cerulean Sea, earlier this year, and we loved it. So we're moving on with this book too. I will do our characters and locations, and Marissa will do the plot. So we have our main character, Wallace. He's a heartless lawyer who has spent his life always chasing the next win. He has been consumed by his work to the point that it ruined his marriage and destroyed friendships. People are scared of him in the office because he fires people for small mistakes. He is not well liked. We have Hugo, a ferryman and tea shop owner. He provides a way station for the dead. He is empathetic to a fault. He does his best to help troubled souls cross over. He takes his job very seriously. He also owns a tea shop and is well liked in the community. He lives with the ghost of his dog, Apollo, the ghost of his grandfather, Nelson, and his reaper, May. Nelson is Hugo's deceased grandfather. After he died, he chose to hang around for a bit and now provides company to his grandson. He is a strong ghost and knows how to move objects and change his clothes and various other tricks. And then we have May. She is a reaper. Wallace is her first assignment. Her job is to take souls to Hugo and help them cross over. She also lives with Hugo and helps him in the tea shop. She is feisty and protective of those she cares about. She also provides some comic relief. There is no defined location. There's a tea shop in the woods. So that's where this takes place.
Yep. Alrighty. Wallace Price, very successful and serious lawyer and partner in his law firm, has died. At his funeral, which is poorly attended and where mostly negative things are said about him, he meets May, his reaper, who escorts him to Karen's Crossing, a tea shop where he meets his ferryman, Hugo. At first, Wallace struggles to accept his death, but with the help of Hugo, May, and Nelson, Hugo's grandfather, he begins to settle more into his afterlife. Nelson helps him to develop his specter skills, and he is eventually able to move chairs and other objects, though he struggles quite a bit with changing his clothes. Wallace realizes that the way that he lived his life when he was alive, mostly unconcerned with the feelings of others and callous, is not how he wants to live in death. And though he starts out as a prick, he, with his new friends, develops empathy and compassion. He and Hugo become closer and eventually develop feelings for each other. But Wallace is dead. And when the manager, who is a shape-shifting being that manages death and all of its facets, comes to the tea shop to resolve an issue with a soul, he also announces that Wallace's time in the tea shop is coming to an end, and Wallace must grapple with what it means to finally have the life that he truly wants and to lose it. Spoilers about. So this is your trigger warning. This book deals very heavily with all issues related to death, including grief and suicide and things like that. So if you're sensitive to those things, monitor yourself appropriately.
So I loved this book. I was a little bit wary going into it for several reasons. I knew it was going to be sad, and I didn't want to be sad. And the last book we read by the author, for me, it felt like I enjoyed it. It was good, but I felt like I was reading a children's book. So I knew going into this was going to be like heavy and, you know, focus on grief and death. And so I was like, oh, I hope it's not written in that style again.
Yeah.
And it was not. So I was very pleased with that. And it was fantastic. It really was. It was a great read.
Yeah. I really enjoyed this book. The House in the Cerulean Sea is still one of my favorite reads from this year, just because it was so wholesome and heartwarming. And I don't think the approach that the author took to writing that book would have worked well in the story. Like, it was written, it was a story about a children's home. It was about children. I feel like the writing style made sense for what the story was about, because we spent so much time with small children as characters. But we didn't have that in this book. There were no children that I can recall. And so I feel like there was a very like adult approach to the story, which is, I think, appropriate because it dealt mostly with death and grief and things like that. So I felt like it fit the way that this story was told fit well. And I enjoyed this book probably just as much as The House in the Cerulean Sea, but my feelings about it were different. Because this one, I mean, there are heartwarming moments. But this book was less like wholesome and heartwarming, although those components were still there, and more deep feelings and a numerous amount of feelings. This one was harder to read, I think.
Yes. Yeah. So we start off this book seeing Wallace being just a total, like you said in the summary, a prick.
He is. All of my notes for the first two chapters as they relate to Wallace are some version of what a dick. Awful.
At first I thought like he wasn't going to be the main character. I was like, oh, this can't be him. He's terrible. I kept waiting for it to like switch to somebody else, you know?
Yeah.
Ah, no, we're stuck with Wallace. And it kind of reminded me a bit about the main character from the House on Cerulean Sea as well, because he was kind of like a bureaucrat, right?
Yes.
You know? So it was kind of like that. But this guy, oof. So we open, the book opens on this woman like sobbing, basically, telling him all of the things that are wrong, you know, going on with her life. Like her husband won't have sex with her. Her daughter got
a septum piercing.
Yeah, septum piercing, right? Like all of these things. And then like how grateful she is that they were providing a scholarship to her daughter. And he's just like, you're fired. Mm-hmm. And she's like, after all of that, he has no empathy or anything. He's just, you're fired. And she's like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he's terrible. He fires her and then he says something like, and thank you, by the way, for reminding me that we gave your daughter a scholarship. We're going to need to revoke that. And he calls HR and it's like, yep, she no longer works for us. So take her daughter's scholarship away. He is the worst.
He's terrible. So then luckily for all of us, and I guess the characters, he dies.
Yeah,
pretty much also immediately of a heart attack. And I love that he was wearing like gray sweatpants and flip-flops. Now he's stuck like that
until he is mortified at his post-life clothing.
Which I love. I thought that was fitting, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay, so his funeral, his thought process in that was both humorous and infuriating. Because he goes there, he expects everybody to be crying.
Yeah. Right?
He's like, and then his ex-wife gets up and basically roasts him, which was great. And he's just so indignant about it. And then he sees May in attendance and he just assumes she's somebody who is obsessed with him and his stalker or something.
Yes. My comment at my note to myself was like, what a narcissist. Oh my gosh.
Terrible.
He's awful. Well, I'm like, so his ex-wife is roasting him. I mean, he was awful to her. The things that she says about him, he is so terrible. He, apparently, like, so what she says is Wallace Price was certainly alive and now he's not. And for the life of me, I can't quite say that's a terrible thing. He was not a good person.
I love that. Just,
it's great. It is great. And then he meets May. And she is doing her, so she's his reaper and she's giving him like the answers that she can. And May is Asian and he makes a comment, has anyone ever told you that you sound like a fortune cookie? And she says, no, because that's kind of racist, seeing how I'm Asian and all. He's like, oh, I didn't mean it that way. He's like, I love how she calls him out. Mm-hmm. And she says, okay, so you didn't mean it that way. Glad to hear it. I know this is all new for you. Maybe think before you talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we see a lot of like, with Wallace, especially initially, we see a lot of like white affluent male privilege in the way that he approaches people in life.
Yes, actually, there's like one of my favorite parts of this book is, oh, I wish I could remember who said it, but they said something along the lines of, you're white male, you'll only fail up.
Yeah, it was his assistant.
Uh-huh. That's right. Yes.
Yep, I highlighted like, that.
I was like, oh my God, this is so true. This is great.
Yes, it was outstanding. Mm-hmm. So many good, I mean, just moments. There's another situation, I think, where they talk about the privilege that he has. I'm like, please, please continue to call this out.
Yes. I wish it was easier to do in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like that thing I watched where the guy had genius of audacity. No one's like, I want to email you.
Did you read at the end of the book May's reaping manual?
Oh, yes. I read some of it.
Yeah, I skimmed the last bit of it. It was pretty funny. The things that they say about, there's one comment that they make about white women in the like introductory part that I think is hysterical. It says, for example, white human women, all caps, experience joy from the phrase live, laugh, love.
Oh, yeah.
If you are assigned to a white human woman, remind her of live, laugh, love, and you're sure to see a smile on her human face.
Oh, yes. That was fantastic.
Oh, the accuracy.
Really? Oh, gosh. All those. I would love to read a book about a reaper, whether it's May or someone else, and like all the different people they encounter.
Mm-hmm. You know?
That would be fun for me.
Yeah.
I think that would be a fun book.
I think so too. I think it's kind of hysterical that when Wallace gets to Karen's Crossing and he sees Hugo,
mm-hmm.
it's not what he expected him to be.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that he expected him to be was Gandalf. He expected Gandalf to be the one ferrying him. It says Wallace didn't know what he was expecting. Perhaps a man in white robes with a long flowing beard surrounded by blazing light and a wooden staff instead of a cane. He expected Gandalf, like Gandalf the White.
Yes, he did. I read
the moment in Fangorn Forest. That is what Wallace was expecting Hugo to be.
I would probably expect that too, though. If I'm being told I'm taking to somebody who is like all like can answer my questions, I would expect like a wise old man or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Hugo is not what Hugo is not what Wallace expected him to be. But also Wallace is still just terrible and awful. And so that first night he is such a jerk. He like stomps around and makes like ghostly sounds and he wakes May up from her sleep and he is awful. Nelson finally hits him with his cane. And my note to myself is, Wallace is terrible. I want him to die again. Like, he's such a dick.
Oh, yes. I love Nelson putting him in his place.
Same. Yes.
That was great.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting that Hugo chooses a specialty for every new soul that they get.
Yes.
I like that the tea gets integrated into the story in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just think that the role that tea drinking serves in this story is really lovely. Mm-hmm. And the memory that it evokes for Wallace is so heartwarming. And it just feels cozy. It takes him back to his childhood when his parents were happy and his mom was making candy canes. It's a peppermint tea. It's nice to see that Wallace is capable of things that are not him being an awful.
Yeah, I think that was the first, like, oh, he's kind of human, sort of.
Yeah.
And that was like, I don't know. 50 pages or more into the book.
Yeah, I mean, it took some time. We got there.
Yeah.
Just took a little time. Yeah. So I really enjoyed the memory that we get to see. And I like the phrase that they connect with tea drinking. So they say, the first time you share tea, you are a stranger. The second time you share tea, you are an honored guest. The third time you share tea, you become family. There is a long history of rituals surrounding tea and tea drinking. And I like seeing it acknowledged in a way in this book.
Yeah. I really wish I could hop on board like the tea craze. I have not found a tea that I enjoy. I need Hugo to pick one out for me.
You do.
Because I
you
want
need
to
him to pick
enjoy
the right
tea.
one.
I would love to enjoy tea, and then I could be, you know, cozy in a blanket, sipping tea, reading a book, right? But,
Yeah.
you know.
They used to have that store. It's called Tea Ivana, like in the mall. I don't know if that's still a thing. Their tea was super expensive. So I don't know if you could, maybe you could go and sample some if something like that still exists.
Yeah.
See if you can find something, because they have like fruity teas. I have one that's got like pomegranate flavors in it right now. It's really good. I do feel like you have a note about this in our notes. I agree with it. When people know that you're a tea drinker, or when tea drinking is like the thing in the story, like that becomes who you are. You're the tea drinker. And I do kind of feel like that in real life too. Oh, you drink tea. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's Marissa.
I
She's the one who drinks tea. That's what happens. She's the tea drinker.
Yeah, that's I do that. Do you drink coffee? What, like, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Oh, this tea thing also reminded me of the grandpa from The Last Airbender, Avatar: The Last
Oh
Airbender.
yeah. Oh
Yeah.
gosh, I haven't thought about or seen that in a long time. Oh, I love that. Oh, that's a
It's
good
so
point.
good. Yeah. What I really enjoy about this book and the way that it approaches death, and especially with Wallace. So Wallace is terrible at the beginning of this book, but pretty quickly his character starts to evolve. Someone makes a point and they say, like, I know that this is different for you, but please acknowledge that, like, not everything is about you, Wallace. And so people are allowed to exist and not have anything to do with you. And I feel like that was in part a turning point for him, because he mostly just thought about himself. And so I really like the way that his character develops and evolves so much in the story, because he would have been intolerable if he had stayed the same from the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
But I also really like the idea that death can be a redemption. Like, you can have a redemptive moment even in your afterlife. It seems like typically when we discuss like life and death and afterlife, the general ideas are good people go to heaven and bad people go to hell, where they get what they have coming to them, which I find terrible. And that is also where I start to struggle with like some of the ideas behind Christianity, because it strikes me as being so contradictory to have a deity who is meant to be loving and forgiving and provide you with choice and give you all of these things, who is also known to smite and punish with an eternity of suffering.
Yeah, that is a big hang up for me as well, because it's like, oh, this is a loving God, but if you don't worship him or do the things the way he says he wants, he's going to burn you forever
Yes,
and
damn you to
ever.
hell forever.
Yeah, I just, it's like, yeah, that's, I don't like that deal.
No, I mean, like, is it really a choice if that's the alternative? Like, that's not really a choice. Like, you
It's
can
not.
choose to follow me or you can suffer forever. Like, that's not choice.
No.
I don't think. So I like that death is not like the end, it's just a step. Kind of like here, it's an in between. But I like that we see the opportunity for redemption with Wallace being an awful person in real life, but in death growing and recognizing that like people can change. And so giving the space for them to change even in their afterlife, I enjoy that.
So me, I do as well. This book reminded me a little bit of The Good Place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So The Good Place came out before the book. It ended like 3 years ago. So I'm going to give like some massive spoilers for the show. So it's been 3 years. I feel like that's okay.
Yeah.
But yes, yeah. If you're listeners, go watch it on Netflix. It's fantastic. So in The Good Place, in the last season, they come up with something very similar to that, is that when somebody dies, they go to like a town basically or whatever, and they're basically taught lessons on what they did wrong in life, and then they get reincarnated, right? And they just keep kind of going through that system to learn to be better, and then once they're, you know, have enough points, I guess, I don't think they kept the point system, then they can go to heaven, right? So there's no hell, there's no eternal torture or anything like that. It's you're given a chance mm-hmm. to get better in this like middle portion, get sent back to Earth, and you know, you do that process.
Yeah.
Which I think is cool.
Mm-hmm.
They also have the door in The Good Place as well, where that's how it ends, because it's like in heaven, eventually your brain turns to mush because you're happy all the time. You can do anything all the time. So when you feel like you have that, you're happy, that you're at peace, you go through this door, mm-hmm. right? And nobody really knows what's on the other side. You know, they say, somebody asks like what's on the other side, and goes, we don't know, but we do know that you'll be at peace.
Right. Yeah.
So that was very similar to this door as well. And yeah, there's a quote from the first season in here as well. It's what is it? Oh, everyone is sad, or all humans are sad a little bit of the time. Or something, are a little bit sad all of the time. That's it. And I love that from The Good Place, and I love it from here too.
Yeah.
So
I appreciate that quote. This is a conversation that I've had with my therapist before, where it's like, I just want to be a happy person.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you're a whole person. You are capable of being happy and sad and angry and joyful and all of the things. It's not happiness is like, well, and I think we talked about this a little bit on our trip. Like happiness is a fleeting emotion, right? So I like the acknowledgement that like we, and this is one of my favorite quotes in this story. Hugo says to Wallace, you contain multitudes. We contain so much. You can be all of the things at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that also is seen in the way that they discuss the grief process
mm-hmm.
as well. So there's the typical five stages, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they point out that it doesn't have to happen in the order that it's put in.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have one and then go back to another one.
Yeah.
Right. And I liked that as well, because people
right, that you just move from one into the other, and then if you go back to one or something like that, that you've done something wrong. That's another conversation I've had pretty extensively with my therapist too. Like you can be in multiple stages at the same time, and you can move out of one for a while and then come back to it. Grief is grief is like such an ongoing it lessens, but it can still be significant, and you can still have things that are activating. And just because you are moving through phases or stages of grief and staying in some for longer and not in others, or in multiple, or going back, like you haven't done anything wrong. Grief is one of the strangest things I've ever experienced, I feel like. I also appreciate in this story that when the manager, Hugo's and May's boss, the manager, shows up, and it's like this ethereal magic stag, which I really like. I feel like that has some callback to like other forms of mythology, so we see a little bit of a mention of Greek mythology here, with the tea shop being called Charon's Crossing, and Charon is the ferryman for the dead in Greek mythology. But the stag is represented, which is something that we see some in like Celtic mythology. So is the forest god Cernunnos presents as a stag. But the manager shows up and Wallace asks him about being God. Mm-hmm. And the manager says, oh, no, that's not really a thing. He says, there is no God, at least not like what you're thinking. He's a human construct, one that's capable of great peace and violent wrath. And it's a dichotomy that's only found in the human mind. So, of course, he'd be made in your image, which I think is an interesting way of presenting that. He also says the truth is infinitely more complicated. And I like that we have this acknowledgement, but I think it probably is life and death and afterlife are nebulous things. So if an afterlife exists, I feel like it would be a lot more complex than the things that our human brains have tried to make it into, just so that we can feel like there's some sense of control for like what's going to happen when you die. I just think humans really like to be in control of things.
Yes.
And death is terrifying. I'm sure it was terrifying thousands and thousands of years ago, and it's still terrifying for a lot of folks today. And so I think that some of the perceptions that we've maybe created surrounding death are things that we've done just to feel like we might have some control over the situation. Mm-hmm. Also, humans really like to punish other people for their perceived wrongs, and I feel like that's where the idea of hell comes in.
Yeah. I don't know if we've talked about this before, or I've talked about it with Tito, or maybe Tito said it, about how like so many cultures have, like you were saying, like an afterlife and everything. And it's very possible it's just how we came up with, you know, a way to cope with
mm-hmm.
death, more so than knowing that that's what's there.
Yeah.
You know? Do you have to say, so they've got the door thing, right? And they, in this series, they know, or in this book, they know that on the other side is something good, right? Mm-hmm. They know they'll be at peace and everything. And I have to say, I would probably be like, that's fantastic. Love that. I'm going to go and see like my whole family, all of my dead friends. Bye.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that these spirits, and especially they seem to be the ones that have died really traumatically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that one guy was stabbed, the other one committed suicide, right?
Yeah.
That they wouldn't really go through for Cameron, the one who committed suicide, right?
Yeah.
He did it after his, weren't they married? No, I don't think they were married, but after his significant other passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he was distraught because his significant other was his whole life. He called him the Sunshine Man or something. Mm-hmm. It was adorable. And so he ended up committing suicide. And the Reaper was terrible, but I do kind of feel like the whole reason that I had committed suicide or something was because I was just horribly missed, you know, my loved ones. That, and then I was like, oh, this door will take me to them. I'm gonna go there. But obviously I've never died. I don't never commit suicide, so I don't know. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
That's how it was in.
Well, I want to say that the way that the Reaper talks to Cameron
mm-hmm.
is not really inviting him to go to the door. So the way that he says there was a door and he knew it, but he didn't trust it. The Reaper had told him that it could lead to just about anywhere. He didn't know, and Hugo didn't know, and no one did, and it could just be an endless darkness, the Reaper mused. It could just be nothing at all. So like the way that the door was presented to Cameron was in a terrifying way. He wasn't told like it could be great things on the other side of the door. It was scary. They say that so at the end of the book, in Karen's Crossing, they get made in charge of helping people who've turned to the husks, so people who've run away, and they turn into like these terrifying creatures. And Hugo is told like there's nothing we can do to help them in the beginning of the book, and so they're tasked with helping the husks cross over. And they mention that there are people who have been there for over 200 years or something who haven't crossed over yet that they help. And so from Cameron's perspective, I can see why he didn't. It sounds like it's terrifying. And if you died and you weren't guaranteed that things were going to be better,
why would you
go?
Right.
Right. I think with some of these situations, it could be like when you start to pull out a splinter. Have you ever had like a really bad splinter or some type of injury or something like that? And you know, it's going to feel better when it's gone, but the act of doing it is terrifying. And the anticipation for it that you create in your mind makes it feel worse.
Yeah.
I feel like it could be something like that. But also, and I've never been dead or dying. But the grief that you experience when you're alive and you watch someone die, or that someone you know that someone you love is going to be dead, or you're watching someone come to terms with dying, I feel like it's represented here really well. Cause like when my brother was dying, like he felt like he was gonna get better. Like right up until he died, he was talking about the things that he was gonna do when he felt better. And so I'm sure that there are people who welcome death, and they talk about how people come to them in this book and they go almost immediately to the door to move on. I think that Hugo probably gets the harder cases, so that maybe doesn't happen as often. But I can also see how people who suffered before their death or who didn't have a choice in their death, like I think his name was Alan, the guy who was stabbed to death, would struggle to move on because either this thing that you had has been taken from you without your choice, or it's not a thing that you wanted to lose. And even with Wallace, like he knows that it could be better on the other side. I mean, there's not like people waiting to greet. Well, I mean, he's got like his parents and things like that on the other side. But he struggles with moving on. Like he struggles to accept that he's dead initially, and he accepts his death pretty well. But even after he's accepted his death, he struggles with moving on through the door too.
Yeah. Well, he's also, well, okay, so the guy who was stabbed, right? I think you're right. His name was Alan. That was super traumatic. I would imagine. Like he was stabbed and he was like trying to ask people for help and people just walked by him. Right. Absolutely terrible. So I would definitely understand the hanging around being angry about that. I guess. And him wanting revenge.
Yeah.
See that for sure.
I would also wonder with, so the way that our, I'm hoping this is changing some, but I feel like the way that suicide is treated or approached in the world that we live in is a lot of times the way that, so the Reaper, the way that he speaks with Cameron about how he just like gave his life up.
Yeah.
People talk about suicide sometimes like it's selfish, like they've just given up. They weren't considerate of maybe the other people around them when they died. They had this thing that was wonderful and they just gave it up so they could be dead. And so I feel like that's kind of represented in the way that we see the Reaper. But when you know that the way that suicide is treated in our world is like that, there may also be feelings of unworthiness associated with moving on through the door too. Like I committed suicide and now maybe I'm not worthy of moving on to a place where I have like joy and peace and happiness and people like that. I wonder if that may play a fact, like be a factor there as well.
Yeah, that's just guilt and shame to keep you from wanting to see your family again.
Yeah.
Don't want to have to admit or talk about what you've done. See that?
Yeah.
Oh, but Cameron broke my heart.
Cameron broke my heart. I definitely cried when I was reading his section. It was just such a, I mean, it was, oh, like a whirlwind of memories. We see him like being criticized and ridiculed by his family for being gay. And then he meets Zach and it like lights up his world. And then they have conflict and, but they're in love and they're happy and they've been together and he has such joy. And then Zach dies so suddenly, and there's no, when people die like that, like there, you don't get like any closure. Like it's just hard. And so to see all of that and then to see his like depression spiral.
Yeah.
It was so sad.
Yeah. Yeah. It got me. It got me. He went through so much and so much pain, was finally happy, and then she's gone and, like, in a second. And he has to come, like, and he meant, or not, he mentions, but you see that his friends and family are trying to reach out, but I don't think he knew what to tell. Like, how do you tell them? Like, you know, I don't know. It was tragic.
Oh, yeah, there are several components of this story that were pretty sad.
Just a couple.
Just a
The rest
couple.
of it was a huge laugh.
Oh, yeah, just a jolly good time. Speaking of jolly good times, May was a great character. We certainly needed her and Nelson and Apollo to provide the comic relief in this story. I'm glad they existed because it would have just been a big sob fest without them.
Yeah, it really would have. She's great. So there's one scene where she comes, like, running out with two knives because it's a health inspector's coming. So she, like, has a knife and, you know, is like, I'm, you know, like, we hate this health inspector. And Hugo was like, no knives. And then Wallace is like, bring the knife. So that was a great moment.
Yes, I love how anytime something happens in their tea shop, May runs out with at least one knife, shouting like, "Are we under attack? Like, what happened to you? Who hurt you, May, that you feel like you're under attack all the time?" May Nelson also was, he provided a good bit of comic relief too. He and Apollo, I mean, a ghost dog, come on. Obviously, we're gonna love that. But Nelson, the way that he was just very snarky, his quips, the way that he interacts with Wallace, it was great. Like hitting him with his cane, so good.
And I love that he's, mentor is not the right word, but he kind of teaches Wallace how to be a ghost, right? And how to change clothes. And there's just, I have no idea how he went from imagining his suit being on to a bikini. That was a great
I
scene.
laughed out loud in that scene. That one. And then again, when he's later on trying to change his clothes and he goes from the sweatpants and flip-flops to a spandex
Oh, yeah.
jumpsuit. So good because he like flashes through a bunch of outfits and he ends up, it's like, I don't know if you've ever tried to get dressed in a hurry because somebody was coming, but this is what I'm like the panic that he's experiencing because he's trying to change into something else before May and Hugo come downstairs. And when they finally show up, he's in like brightly colored briefs and pleather thigh-high boots. Like, can you imagine the panic?
God, that's
I was
incredible.
laughing so hard.
It was great. There were some very funny moments in this book, which were
Absolutely.
very much needed.
Definitely. Yes. May's character, she's so funny. I also, so they have this conversation with Desdemona, the what is she called? Is she
Oh, she calls it, is she a psychic, basically?
Yeah, something like that. She shows up in their shop and May is furious. And she's having a conversation with Hugo and Wallace, like, can I just stab her a little bit? And Wallace is like, no, like I'm dead and I couldn't defend you if that was the case. And like he's talking through the legal ramifications of murdering Desdemona with May, like it's an actual option. It was great. I also really like so we have diversity in the characters in this book, of sexual orientation and race and things like that, which I love. Three of the characters, so there I've if we count Apollo as a character, so five of our like main and supporting characters in this book, well, one of them is a dog, but three of them are non-white folks, which is amazing. So we have some like racial diversity, but also we have some LGBTQ representation. Our two main characters, so Hugo is gay and Wallace is bisexual. And I love the support that we see. I'm just like in the bathroom sign that they mention in Karen's Crossing. It says guys, gals, and not our non-binary pals. Like I love it.
Yeah.
I saw a sign in a restaurant in Little Rock last night that said something similar, and it just made my heart so warm.
I like seeing more acceptance of that, especially in the real world. Like you said, you saw a sign in Little Rock. That's so cool to see. I don't think I have, although I don't go out too much anymore. I like that. Really see a whole bunch of public restrooms. But I like seeing more acceptance in the books. We've talked about it before. It's just in general, seeing more diversity and more inclusion. And if it's it's Pride Month, right?
It's Pride Month. And I feel like especially, I don't know, the fantasy genre is super weird about like, so we talked about this a little bit, like during the release of the Rings of Power on Amazon. So I'm in these fantasy groups and people were like, it's just bizarre to me that the fantasy community can be really accepting of like wizards and dwarves and elves being people. But if you have black dwarves or black elves or things like that, then that's a problem. There was so much racism that showed up when they released the Rings of Power because the cast wasn't an all white cast. Like, why can you be okay with there being elves? But if they're black elves, it's a problem.
Yeah.
And so especially I don't know, it just kind of seems like that's maybe the fantasy world has been a little bit slow, and so it's nice to see in a fantasy book that we have Asian characters and black characters and that LGBTQ representation. Like, it's wonderful.
I agree.
Back to some sad parts. When Hugo talks about his parents dying, I cried. He says, I was told it was over in an instant, but that stuck with me for a long time because it was over for me in an instant. And yet it feels like it's still happening sometimes. There were a lot of components in this book that reminded me of like the way that I experienced grief after my brother died. It's been almost 2 years. And death and grief are some of the strangest things that I've ever experienced before. So it'll feel like it's been a long time. And then sometimes it feels like it's been no time at all. It feels like he just died. And like, I don't know. The first year after he died, it was pretty bad, but it was like mostly focused on just like getting, you know, through the day. And so my therapist told me, like, I don't want you to be alarmed, but for a lot of people, the second year after a person dies is worse than the first. And I thought, how could that possibly be the case? Because the first year was awful. And she was totally right. There are absolutely parts of the second year that are worse than the first year because you're not just focused on surviving anymore. You have the space for more. And so holidays were much worse. And my birthday was much worse because, I don't know, I was reminded like that I am getting older and my brother will not ever get older. And his birthday is in 8 days and I already feel just so tearful about it. Those types of like anniversary markers are hard. So I think that the way that death was written about and that grief was written about in this story is a really good representation for the way I at least have experienced some of these things in real life. I think that it was handled beautifully and very well. So they get Alan, who is a soul who is murdered and very much struggles with death. And Hugo struggles with his interactions with him because Hugo is angry and scared, and the way that he talks with not Hugo, Alan is angry and scared. And so the way that he talks with Hugo and even May is rough. And so at one point in the story, we see Hugo outside having a panic attack and Wallace goes to support him and is just very quiet about his support, which I think is sweet and lovely. He just sits near him. He doesn't go and try to hug him or force him out of his panic attack or whatever. He sits by him. And he just starts tapping his finger as like a gentle reminder that I'm here if you need me. You're not alone, without it being like an aggressive form of support. which I think is really nice, like these gentle forms of intimacy and just being present with people without forcing them to try to feel something else. I think that's so important and kind.
And he learned it because of his ex-wife, Naomi. She used to have panic attacks. And so that's where he learned it. So it's interesting. I mean, so it's interesting to see then his character. We know in the past he must have had some empathy because he did that for his wife, right? Yeah. And it's brought up that he did truly love her at one point. But it's yeah, it's an interesting juxtaposition, I guess.
And then his panic attack resolves and they start to go back into the tea shop, and Wallace says to Hugo, "I wish I had found you before, not someone like you, but you in my heart," just like, meh.
I know, this was the so it's again, so even like with the House on the Cerulean Sea too, it's a very subtle romance.
Yeah.
Which there's something about it that I really like, but
it's so sweet.
It is so sweet. Oh, sorry.
You're fine. They're just precious. The way that they interact with each other, because like Wallace is dead and is gonna move on, and so I would imagine it would be hard to let yourself fall in love with someone when you know that their existence in your life is very transient. And so then they make another comment where it's like, if things were different, like, would you? And Wallace imagines himself like just happening to meet, like he entertains the fantasy of happening to meet Hugo and them being together. And they make these little comments about if things were different, then, and, ugh.
I love that scene when Hugo was like, stay in bed with me, right? Because even though Wallace can't sleep, and then they talk to each other and they talk through their fantasy of how they would meet, what they would do, what they would say. And oh, it was sad.
Yeah, it was sad. Sweet. It was sweet. It was lovely. Like,
it's very cute.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine also. So it's mentioned several times that they use May sort of as an in between. It's like, give a hug to Hugo, give a hug to Wallace for May. It was cute too.
It was so cute.
May being the in between like that.
Yeah.
It's sweet.
Desdemona, the medium, I think that's what she calls herself, not psychic, medium, whatever, the person. The way that she was weirdly sexual about invoking spirits.
That was so bizarre. I was just, what?
Oh, so cringe. She says, fill me with your ghostly ectoplasm. No, ma'am. That's not how we talk to ghosts. She was also super rude. Like, she commanded them to speak with her. Like, that's rude. You could be friendly. Be cordial to the ghost.
That's how you get a demon.
Yeah, yes. It is. I loved when Wallace took over that situation initially when she shows up, and May wants to murder her, and she and Wallace, I think he throws her Ouija board across the room, but he also like writes like, I am Satan. And she asks like, who murdered you? And he writes Desdemona's name, and she's like, I think it's time to go.
I love that. Oh, and that, what, they have thin man and short man or something.
Yeah.
Right. And I hope they were writing down the words. Right, or the letters.
Yeah.
And they were spelling out her name, but they got to the part where it says demon, and they're like, it spells, they had horrible spelling, I think, right? They had they were very bad at their spelling skills.
Yeah. It was a funny scene. But then she comes back, so they invite her back later for their scene with Nancy, which was super sad. So to get to this point, the manager shows up and he takes care of Alan, who was causing a lot of disruption in Karen's crossing in the tea shop. And the manager says, like, look, Wallace, I don't know why you're still here, but it's time for you to move on. So you have 7 days to kind of tie all this up, and then you're going. Mm-hmm. And Wallace is understandably very upset. He's in love with Hugo. Hugo's in love with Wallace. They love each other. Everybody loves Wallace now. Nelson, May, like, everybody loves each other. They're a family. And so he's really upset, but this is like a catalyst of action for him. It seems like to me, he's like, okay, if I'm going to start tying things up, like, we need to do something about this situation with Nancy, the woman who comes into the shop every day because her daughter stopped in the shop as a soul when she had died. and cried out for her mom across wherever. And her mom felt her and came because she could feel something.
Oh gosh, wait,
So sad.
that was terrible. First off, because she like screamed for her mom as that Reaper, I think, was throwing her through the door, which is what brought her mom. So when her mom got there, her spirit was gone because that jerk of a Reaper, right, purposely like pushed her through the door before she was ready. Which was so tragic. So by the time she gets there, her daughter's already gone. No, so sad.
It is sad.
And then she, I guess she kind of, it stuck with her, right? All of that. So she keeps returning to the shop.
Yeah, hoping for some kind of sign or something. And Desdemona had previously tried to summon her daughter, and obviously it didn't work. And so she's just got like lots of resentment and anger and frustration and heartbreak because her daughter is still dead. And so they try again with Desdemona, and it obviously doesn't work because she has moved on. And Wallace and Hugo work together to kind of bring some closure to Nancy's situation, which was lovely and sad.
Yeah, they I guess used what they knew from her daughter to still kind of communicate with the mother. So it's Wallace who has the chalk, right? He's the ghost. He writes out, he tries to write out messages to her. And it, yeah, and it helps, right? It helps her.
Yeah, it helps her. She moves back to her home. It ends up being such a great moment for Hugo too, because Wallace is the one that says, like, she your daughter's not here anymore. But Hugo ends up being the one, and Wallace helps to facilitate this moment for him. Hugo ends up being the one that, like, brings all of the comfort, right? He serves her the gingerbread tea, which is her daughter's favorite, and he tells her the stories of his interactions that he had with her daughter. It's just really sweet. But it's a big moment for Hugo, I think, too, because he, I think, struggles with, he's a very empathetic person. So I think he struggles with like the confines in his job and the things that he's allowed to do. And this is a moment that he experienced a lot of regret with when it came to the way that Nancy's daughter passed and her being forced through the door. And so he has this moment where he gets to make the situation right for him. And Wallace kind of supports him through it. And it was just a really great and sad moment. As a continuation of Wallace's last week, he and Hugo go on this ride on Hugo's scooter, and he can feel himself like starting to disintegrate because when you get too far from the tea shop, the person starts to disintegrate, and so he can feel it. And so they hurry back, and he has the moment with Cameron where he pulls the hook that's been connecting him to Hugo this whole time out of his chest, and he slams it into Cameron's chest, and he becomes a spirit again. He's not a husk anymore.
And Wallace turns into a balloon.
Yeah. And they use a leash to keep him tied down to things.
Hysterical. That made me laugh.
Yeah.
For sure. Because I think at one point May says, "You're not a balloon." Like, he's a balloon.
The manager comes for Wallace. It's his last day. Breaks my heart. I'm crying because he keeps saying, like, please don't forget me. I don't have a lot of people that would remember me, but I want you to be one of them, talking to Hugo, but also Nelson and May. And like he just wants to be remembered by them because they're important to him, which made me cry a lot. The manager comes and is like, all right, Wallace, it's time to go. And basically everyone is very upset about it. Hugo's like, nope, I don't like this. I don't support it, and I won't be part of it or whatever. Like it's not a good time. And the manager, I don't know, does his like manager magic and was like, meh, I think we can just make you in charge of taking care of the husks because that's a thing. And he makes Wallace a human again. and Wallace and Hugo get to live happily ever after. Ish. Happily ish ever after. And he makes Wallace responsible for being a Reaper. So May starts training him.
Mm-hmm.
You don't love the way this story ended?
I was not a huge fan of it because earlier the manager made this whole big thing about, like, you can't bargain with me, you can't do this, like, this is happening, you're going through the door, right? Like, that's it. And then it's sort of like all of a sudden he's like, meh, just kidding.
Yeah.
So it was weird. That was a weird flip.
Yeah.
But I think it would have been good for Wallace to have to leave, right? You know, and then the epilogue could be Hugo meeting him there, right? Mm-hmm. Them meeting back up again.
Yeah.
Which I think would have been, I mean, like, it's great that they have this happily ever after. I just feel like it was kind of out of character for the manager, especially based on what he had said before.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would have been the ending I picked, but I'm not the author, so.
Right. Yeah. And I think that would have been a good ending too, but man, it would have hurt my heart for Wallace to leave and for Hugo to have to live the rest of his life without him. Wow, that would have been hurtful. So I'm okay with the way that this ended. It was really sad when Nelson decided it was time for him to go and then Apollo to go with him in the epilogue.
Yes.
That made me feel some things too. But I was at, like, I enjoyed the ending. Mm-hmm. And I like seeing it. Again, it kind of comes back to the redemption. Wallace was such a dick in his first life, but in his second life, he has the opportunity to make it so much better. And he does. And he takes all of the lessons and the things that he's learned from other people and acknowledges that he still makes mistakes, but he's doing better than he was before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really highlights the impact that having people to support you in your life has on the way that you live your life. But also being open to those things. So you have to want to change, right? Mm-hmm. You can have all of the support, but if you don't want it for yourself, it does not happen. So we see this nice coming together of having the support that you need, but also wanting to do the work
mm-hmm.
in Wallace's second life.
Oh, I also like that Wallace did reach out to his wife or ex-wife, mm-hmm. you know, as well as his ex-partners, whatever,
yeah.
To get that woman her job back and the scholarship back.
Yes, I liked that too.
It's like, all right, we're bringing it full circle here with this, you know,
mm-hmm.
this poor woman who,
yeah,
at this point, who knows how long it's been.
Yeah, really.
Because, like, it was
she may have a new job.
Yeah. And it's been 3 days. It was 3 days for his funeral, and then he spent at least a month
mm-hmm.
there. She might have a new job.
He tried to, it's like Ebenezer Scrooge, like trying to right his wrongs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I liked the description of the whispering door, the door that, so it's in the ceiling. And the people who are getting ready to pass over, they hear like sounds, they hear like communication things talking to them that gets louder the closer they get to the door and the more ready they get to go into the door. It reminded me a little bit of the arch that Sirius Black goes through in the Order of the Phoenix when he dies.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, like he goes through it. You can hear like sound coming from it. I also love the joy that everyone experiences when they're moving through the door.
Mm-hmm. And how they say, I think when Nelson goes through, he says, oh my God, it's everything.
Mm-hmm.
Basically.
Yeah. That's great. I love this story.
You know what also reminds me a little bit of, have you watched the show Dead Like Me?
No, I don't think so.
So the main character is a Reaper, right? And so she takes people's souls and she's like, you gotta leave, like, go to your next thing. But so whenever the person is kind of ready to pass on, their version of heaven sort of appears. So like this little girl dies and like when it's time for her to go, I guess, which was pretty quickly, this like carnival appears and she's like, oh, a carnival, and she runs into it and it goes away. So I kind of also pictured it like that, like it's everybody, like they're going there to what their paradise would be.
Do you have any more quotes you want to share?
Okay, so I had that everyone is a little bit sad. But I also had I've learned from my mistakes even as I continue to make new ones. And Hugo says this. And I think it's important to learn from your mistakes and be aware that you're going to make new ones and not be paralyzed with crippling fear about making mistakes.
Yep, that's a conversation I have with my therapist. Because my mentality is like, well, I can avoid failure by not trying at all.
There you go. You can't fail if you didn't try.
That's right. Yeah, I like that one. I also like this one, and Nelson says this. It's never enough, is it? Time. We always think we have so much of it, but when it really counts, we don't have enough at all. Facts.
It's weird how time moves.
Yeah.
Know, it's like, how am I like 30?
Yeah, time is like fast and slow and weird at the same
Yeah.
time. Yeah.
The days are long, but the years are short.
All right, well, that wraps up Under the Whispering Door by TJ Klune. Join us next time. We'll be covering another Pride Month read, and we hope you join us for that one too. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to Literary Quest. We hope you enjoyed our episode. If you'd like to follow us on social media, we can be found at Literary Quest Podcast on Instagram or Facebook. You're also welcome to share your thoughts and ideas with us via email at literaryquestpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.